It's now 2 p.m. Can everyone hear me? Please feel free to come up front. Let me just offer an encouragement for you to do that. We don't bite. And also, it'll just be a more interactive experience. And we won't get upset if you have to leave early or judge you or anything. Just come up front if you can. Thank you. Okay. My name is Allison Pugh, and I am a professor of sociology here at the University of Virginia. And I want to welcome everybody on behalf of Virginia Humanities, which is the producer of the Virginia Festival of the Book. Let me ask you now to please silence your cell phones. I should probably do the same. Yeah. Just to be sure. That said, if you want to tweet about the event, you can, using the hashtag VABookFest. I want to thank this event's sponsor or host. That's the Ballyshannon Fund. I want to remind you all that the festival is free of charge, but not free of cost. And if you are so inclined, to please go online to support, to give back, or you can pick up an envelope from the information desk at the Omni and support the festival so that we can sustain it for many more years. They also ask that we remind you to fill out the program evaluations, which are, I think, this bright yellow piece of paper. And you can do that via paper, or you can complete that online at vabook.org/survey. And please support festival authors and our local booksellers by purchasing a book today, if you are so moved. The authors will be available for book signing after the program. And so today we're talking to the authors of this book, and the title of our program is The Socioeconomic Politics of Food and Family. And their book that they have written together is called Pressure Cooker: Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. Actually, look, this is a looks much better. And here's who's talking to you. So I'm just doing it in order, not of who they are next to me, but in maybe I will do it by order of who's next to me. That makes sense, because I think all authors contributed equally to this project. So sitting next to me is Seneca Elliott. She's assistant professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And she received her PhD at the University of Texas at Austin and taught for 9 years at North Carolina State University. What are they doing? They're like this, isn't that right? No. That's what Christine always does.
That's Texas.
Oh, that's just Texas in general.
And I always get those things wrong.
So I do.
That was my shtick when I used to teach there.
Oh, really?
What is it we do?
Yeah, anyway. So she taught also for 9 years at North Carolina State University before moving to Canada in 2017. Her first book was entitled, and this is great, get ready, Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers. It's really good. It really is a great book. And that was published in 2012 by New York University Press. And she's also the author or co-author of 29 journal articles or book chapters, and that's a lot, especially when we're talking about qualitative work. So that's a pretty impressive record. Right next to her is Sarah Bowen. She's an associate professor of sociology at North Carolina State University. And she received her PhD in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, basically duking it out for number one or number two in the country. She teaches classes and conducts research related to health, food, inequality, and development. She's the author of Divided Spirits, Tequila, Mezcal, and the Politics of Production. That came out in 2015. And for the 2017-18 academic year, she actually was a guest researcher in Sweden at the University of Gothenburg, where she studied the processes that shape how immigrants' diets change after they move to a new country, which is really interesting. She also was the PI and the director, PI means in academic speak, principal investigator, and director of what's called Voices in Action, the Family Food and Health Project, which is part of what generated this book that we're gonna be talking about today, and that's focused on food insecurity and food access among low-income populations in North Carolina. She has received a Fulbright Fellowship, presented her research at the White House, been part of research teams receiving millions of dollars in funding from the NSF, the USDA, and the CDC, among others. So. Then we have Jocelyn Brenton, is that right? Brenton is assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Ithaca College. And she received her PhD at North Carolina State University. You're starting to figure out where all these authors met each other. In 2014. And she actually spent 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in Guinea, West Africa, grew up in rural Maine. Her research has been covered in The Atlantic, The New York Times, Slate, PBS NewsHour, et cetera. So these are our panelists. Have we decided what we're doing?
I can read a short
question. Okay, so this is how it's gonna go. We're gonna kind of basically talked for 40 to 45 minutes or so, maybe a little, 42 minutes, where Seneca will read briefly from the book. I'll tell you a little bit about what I think is like my favorite parts, the best part. Then I've actually prepared 10 or so questions for them. They'll answer as see fit. We'll cut ourselves off at about 2:40, mm-hmm. and then we'll listen to you, and if you guys have any questions. Then we'll probably end the session at, I guess that would be 3, and then you guys can sign for the next half hour, kind of, if that works. Mm-hmm. And, we can go a little longer or whatever. Okay, so why don't we hear from whatever excerpt you would like to give us.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. It's great to see you. It's great to be here. And thank you, Allison, for those opening remarks. And also for giving us the suggestion to read from our book. This is the first time we've come to the book festival. And we usually do academic talks where you're really basically duking it out about ideas. And the idea of just luxuriating in words is marvelous. So I'm excited about this. But we just very quickly on the fly chose a short excerpt to read from. And so in the book, we're looking at 7 foodie messages that tell us that if we just return to the kitchen, cook from scratch, make good shopping decisions so that we can eat well within a budget, we can solve a lot of big issues that are confronting us these days, from obesity and diet-related diseases to fragile families that feel buffeted from all sides, to the health of the planet even. And so what we're talking back to is the idea that just with a little bit of grit and know-how and determination and commitment, that families in their individual kitchens can really solve some of these larger issues. And so I want to start with the first substantive chapter in the book where we introduce you to one of the 9 families that we feature in the book. So here we go, we'll see how this goes. You need to come and say grace before dinner, Patricia Washington announces as she removes a sizzling Tony's pepperoni pizza from the microwave. Patricia's age is hard to judge. She keeps her salt and pepper hair short with her bangs pushed back. Given her smooth brown skin, she could be in her late 40s, but her 2 missing front teeth and stooped posture create the appearance of someone well beyond her 58 years. It's hot, she advises her grandchildren, carefully divvying up slices of pizza between 4-year-old Mia and 1-year-old Jaden. She puts Jaden's 3 small slices in a blue plastic bowl. Mia's 3 slices sit in a black plastic bowl, recycled from last night's TV dinner. Patricia picks Jaden up from the carpet and expertly situates him on her hip. Without prompting, Mia scrambles onto the bathroom vanity to wash her hands. With her knees on the counter to steady herself, she hunches over the sink basin, trying to grasp the knob of the faucet. She wears skinny jeans and a pink t-shirt. At four, Mia is small for her age. Her petite frame, combined with her broad smile and infectious laugh, have a magical effect on adults, who often comment on how cute she is. She's very cute. Teetering, Mia manages to turn the faucet off. She's still on the cabinet, and wash her hands, but getting down presents a dilemma. I can't get down, she calls to Patricia, who has her hands full with Jaden. Mia's legs dangle over the side of the counter, searching for a foothold. Eventually, her foot finds the edge of a beige plastic wastebasket under the sink. She steadies herself enough to get down and walks over to where Patricia is sitting with Jaden on her lap. Like his sister, Jaden is petite. At his last doctor's visit, he was in the fifth percentile for height and weight. He has delicate features and dark hair cut close to his head. He's dressed in a t-shirt and diaper. Patricia decided it wasn't worth putting his shorts back on after she changed him the last time, since it will be time for bed soon. Finally, with everyone situated, Patricia begins the dinner prayer. God is great and God is good, she says in her soft voice. Mia repeats each line after her, and we thank him for our food. By his hand we must be fed. Give us, Lord, our daily bread. Steam rises from the slices of pizza. Mia holds her bowl up to her face. Delicately, she blows on it. Still hot, Mama, she reports. Jaden copies her, blowing dramatically into his bowl. After a minute, Mia bites into the chewy crust, struggling to tear it away from the rest of the slice. Jaden pops an entire wedge of pizza, half the size of his hand, into his mouth. Mm-hmm. Patricia doesn't eat. Sandra, Patricia's daughter and the children's mother, usually joins them for dinner. Today, however, she's still out job hunting and won't be back until later. An episode of Family Feud is playing on the outdated television set. One of the contestants shouts something. Oh yeah, that's a good answer, Patricia tells the contestant, glancing at the TV. It's a familiar scene, except that Patricia and the kids aren't at a kitchen table or even in a kitchen. With plates on their lap, they are all crowded into a hotel room, sitting on one of two full-sized beds that takes up most of the space in room 105, where the family has been living for the past 4 months. So that gives you some insight into the socioeconomics of food, is what we look at in the book. And I'd like to say that Patricia Washington and her daughter Sandra and her kids were part of the group of families that we followed over 5 years in North Carolina. And when we first met them, they were housed. And when we approached them about being in this portion of the study, which involved spending intensive amounts of time with the families as they cooked and ate and went grocery shopping, went to social services offices and doctor's appointments, we learned that they had been evicted from their home, as is so common in the U.S. today. And we said we would wait. She said, we think we're going to get housing soon. And we said, we'll wait, that's fine. And eventually it became clear that that was not going to happen. And they asked us to go ahead and come with us. It was very difficult. It was a difficult decision, and it was difficult to see a family that was living in such conditions. But it did give us an opportunity to understand what it takes to feed a family when you don't have a kitchen. And that's one of the points we want to make in the book, that home cooking doesn't solve your problems if you don't have a kitchen. They had a hot plate, they had a microwave, and they had a small fridge. But I'll stop there, because I know that you have some questions for us. Well,
that's
thank
great.
You for listening.
That was a really good opening. Exactly. Nice capture. So, as you can tell, I think, from even that tiny excerpt, this is a very powerful story. 1 in 8 Americans don't get enough to eat. The U.S. tracked food insecurity since 1995, and more than 20 years, there's been no measurable improvement. I went to a hunger banquet, which is kind of an oxymoron, put on at the local high school, Charlottesville High School. I went to that on Wednesday. And that's where they are trying, you bring donations and they're collected by the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, and it's to highlight the extent of food insecurity in America. And a member representative from the food bank came. And he said, before the Great Recession, you would see perhaps individuals you might expect to rely on food pantry help, like people with disabilities, people maybe who had just lost their job, maybe seniors living on a fixed income. But since the Great Recession, they've been seeing many more families with children and many more people who household representing households where people are actually working. More than 40% nationally, more than 40% of households who use a food bank include at least one employed adult, and 43% have children under 18 years old, and this is the population that you're reading about in this book. So I'm a sociologist, and I am used to hearing about inequality. That is our bread and butter. And yet, I learned a lot from this book. Most profound, as I was telling them before you all arrived, was this kind of step-by-step account of a mom and her daughter going to the office of the WIC program. That's the Special Supplemental Program for Women, Infants, and Children that the U.S. Offers food subsidies, coupons basically for them to collect to get dairy products and other things. So at this meeting, at this appointment, they weighed the daughter and took her blood to measure her iron without a lot of sympathy. And then they reported that she gained 3 pounds and she didn't have a commensurate increase in height, so they were worried about that. And they proceeded to kind of pigeonhole the mom about her bad choices. And as the authors note, when Jade, that's the daughter, gains weight, the WIC counselor tries to figure out what Melanie, the mom, is doing wrong at home. It is a chilling episode of humiliation. And Melanie, who, this comes two-thirds of the way through the book, so we've actually met Melanie throughout, and she's an active parent. One of those kinds of moms who takes like every opportunity to make a teachable moment, teaching opportunity. She's even in the WIC reception area, Jade was like, "Am I going to the doctor?" And she's like, "No. This is a nutritionist. This is the difference." You know, she's like a careful, active mother, and she talks to them in interviews about how she wishes she could buy organic food, afford it. She wishes the meat didn't have hormones. Would like to participate in a community-supported agriculture kind of arrangement, but can't afford it, etc. And this experience of coming to WIC, where they're like, "Jade's up 3 pounds. Are you giving her soda? How are you controlling on it?" It's very well depicted, and you feel that humiliation, and just you feel demoralized with Melanie, and you watch her demoralization. She enters a confident and careful, or I don't know, confident, she enters a careful mother, and she leaves a really demoralized one. That was very powerful, just as a vignette. Okay, so I have some questions, and I'd love to hear what you all have to say. So the book points to a number of different important issues that shape the capacity of families to provide healthy food for their families. And that's my first question. Why are these all mothers? Like, where are the men who cook? So let's just start with that. And I don't know how you want to decide who answers, but yeah.
So we've gotten that question a lot. Yeah. And when we were designing the study, we decided to focus on mothers because women still, even if you look at national surveys, women still do the bulk of the food work. They've done surveys in 75% of households, women say they still do most. But I think it's beyond that women also feel disproportionately responsible for the food work, and they also, there have been experiments, I think that this will not come to a big surprise to mothers, but where they did experiments and they found that when people were told this parent is not feeding this kid healthy food, that if it was a mom, they judged the mom for being a bad mom for not feeding the kid healthy food, but if they were told it was a dad, they were like, meh, well, at least the kid is getting fed. And
that's our standard,
right?
Caloric intake.
So we decided that, and so we focused on the mothers in part because you can only do so much. But over the course of the 5 years, we observed a lot of, we ended up talking to a lot of dads. We saw a lot of dads in the observations, And in almost all of these households, like, we did not see the dads helping that much. And we talk about this a little bit in the book, that when the dads did help, it was often for kind of special occasions. Like, one of the moms was Leanne, and she made this huge, we have a chapter where she makes this huge 4th of July meal. She spends the whole time cooking, and then, like, far into it, her husband comes in and works his magic, which is brushing some rib sauce on the ribs. Like, that's his big role. And then he goes back out, you know, to hang out while Leanne continues to cook. And so, if you look at statistics, men overall are cooking more than they were in, like, the 60s, for example, but women still do the bulk of work. And I cannot help but notice when I look out at the audience that there are a lot of women in the audience and not a lot of men.
Your subtitle is Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What Can We Do About It. What are the problems that you are talking about in particular in that subtitle?
Thanks, Allison. Thanks for being here again today. So we do have some very real problems with food, right? We have health-related problems. We have high rates of obesity among adults and children these days. We have type 2 diabetes. And so we have a lot of concerns around that. We also people have concerns about the sustainability of our food system. How much longer, right, can we keep producing food at this rate or wasting food at this rate, and what impact is that having on our environment? And so these are some of the problems that we're looking at, and they are real problems that we need to be tackling. I mean, the biggest thing we're saying in the book is, are people's kitchens the place where we want to be tackling this? Is this where we're going to be able to solve all of these problems? Because there's lots of reasons why people are obese, for example, right? Or have type 2 diabetes. And it isn't necessarily about what's going on in somebody's kitchen. And so, you know, that's sort of the backdrop, right? And that's why people really, I mean, when we started writing about this, we published a smaller article in 2014, and it got a lot of attention. And we realized, oh, okay, like, food, the family meal, these are really hot button issues for people. People feel very strongly about food. Food has been a part of all of our lives for so long. People have lots of positive memories around food. Many of the women we talked with had a lot of memories around food that weren't so positive, right? So this is an important part of, you know, the landscape right now, and there are some problems. But we sort of take issue with some of the folks and some of the messages we hear about how we can solve it.
So I teach sociology of family, as well as a bunch of other things, but that's why I'm surprised you didn't mention that problem, because that was the one that really stood out to me. Like, yes, there's health and obesity and diabetes, and yes, there's the environmental impact of our food industry and agricultural agribusiness, but when I hear the judgment around home cooking, it really feels aimed at family cohesion, family connection.
Yes.
Families today are fragmenting. We don't know each other. We don't spend time together. And the
yes.
family meal is seen as a corrective to that. So I would just, don't forget that one.
Yes.
That one feels really important.
And we, yes, absolutely. And we talk about that in the introduction as
yeah.
well. And that, you know, you'll hear these studies that say that eating around the table can solve things like childhood delinquency, right? Or... Right, yeah, and so you're like, is this a direct connection? Like, what is that? Yeah, the children will get better grades, right? They'll have less symptoms of depression. And, yeah, so absolutely. That is a big part of this landscape as well, that people really feel like with you know, high rates of divorce, that we have just a moral problem with where families stand these days. And the table really is seen as, like, a centerpiece of how families do family life and come together at the end of the day and share their experiences. And, you know, we'll probably get into it. People often talk about that like it's always a dreamy and rosy affair. And I think any of us who have fed children, and we all have children, know that it's not always an easy time of day sitting around the table. And it's sometimes full of conflict and strife.
I think one thing to add, that as we were doing the research for the book, not the interviews, but sort of the background, and historians, we were just talking to a historian about this, is how much this, like, concerns with the family dinner have been tied to people's views of motherhood and family for so long. Mm-hmm. And so what we're supposed to do at the dinner table has changed, but it's always tied to this anxiety. And in the in the time of industrialization, when people were shifting from eating their main meal in the middle of the day, it was lots of farmers and people that worked close to home, and they would have the big dinner in the middle of the day, and they were switching more to an evening meal. Like, people were raising such concerns about that too, and saying, like, this will be the downfall of the family. We found this quote from someone around, this was around like 1900, who wrote, like, if women don't have to make dinner until nighttime, they'll surely give away the day to idleness and gossip. And so they were saying, like, this will be sinful and lazy. And so it is interesting that too, how these concerns with family and dinner have been tied for so long.
So that's kind of why I was asking, because to me the subtitle says there's some, I'm interested in, I don't want to say slippage, but there's some thing you're, there's problems that other people are pinning to food, and then there's problems that you actually are thinking, like, what we can do about it. So the problems that you think are problems. So I just wanted to hear, what are the problems you're talking about? And I think what we've got is the first two, health and environment, are ones that maybe we can address, and the family togetherness. I'm just interested in, are we talking about problems that are out there and hyped, and the, you know, for which the home meal is posited as a perfect solution, or are we talking about problems that you think that you can solve, and maybe that there's overlap there? And that I'm tagging that. Tacking that question onto how do we solve these problems then?
Okay. So, yes, if you put this in your subtitle, then you have to have some solutions.
Yeah.
Although I have to say that as sociologists, we're always a little bit concerned about offering any kind of solutions or sort of a dogmatic approach. But we absolutely, we do spend a lot of time talking about what are some alternatives. If we're saying we need to turn away from focusing so intently on what's happening in people's kitchens to looking at solutions that might occur outside of individual kitchens, what are those? And I'm a family sociologist, as Allison is, so I will say that one of the things that we talk about in the book is just how families in the U.S. have so few supports for family life, for carving out, you know, the time to be a family and to do family in whatever guise that might take. And when you look at families in other nations that have more supportive family-friendly policies, parents in those countries are way happier than the parents are here in the U.S., right? The U.S. parents rank very low on happiness scales, and that's partly because they're in this kind of pressure cooker of survival, work, pay the bills, keep a house over our head, get these kids in school, oh man, unequal funding, their schools are falling apart, they don't have textbooks, or I'm really nervous that my child needs to get in these AP classes because I want them to get, you know, competitive college applications, right? And it's very much a lot of pressure that parents are feeling, and this is coming out in these surveys where U.S. parents rank among the lowest in happiness scales. And what scholars have found is when they factor in all of these other things, including inequality and other things, that it is the lack of family-friendly policies that ultimately are generating this unhappiness for parents. So if we can have more supportive policies, if we can have things like, and these are simple things in many ways, so things like paid sick leave, paid family leave, subsidized quality daycare, health care, right? These are things that are going to boost families, benefit their health and well-being, and improve their emotional well-being as well. So that's one thing that I like to talk about. That can solve some of the sense of that dinner is a pressure cooker, and that all the weight is on the shoulders of individual families to solve these things that are pressing down upon them. And I'll let Sarah and Jocelyn talk about some of their solutions.
So in response to your question, like, what are the problems that we see as real, Sinica's talked
yes.
about, like, across the board, rich and poor moms and working class moms, they felt like they were failing and they were frazzled, and, you know, they blamed themselves, but how can we support them? They didn't necessarily blame that they're doing this basically on their own. Mm-hmm. I think the other, another big problem that we saw, which you kind of pointed to in your intro, is that there is a lot of inequality in how people in the United States eat, both in terms of like, you know, families that are supposed to that experience food insecurity, and if you look at like dietary surveys, in the last 10 years, people's diets are actually starting to get a bit healthier. So like, and some of those are kind of across the board, like people of all income levels are drinking less soda than they were before and eating more whole grain. But then the gap between like the dietary quality in terms of like how well does the government think we're doing at meeting what they tell us we're supposed to do, which is kind of debatable, we could debate that too, has grown. And that's mostly because it's rich people who are eating more fresh produce, especially fresh fruit. And then a lot of the moms in our study said, you know, my kids love fruit and I would love to give them fruit, but we do it like maybe once a month because it's really expensive, it goes bad fast. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that, I think the most important thing we could do would be to think about food as a human right, which I had read about that for many years before I really started thinking about what that means. And I think what it means is you take as a given that we all deserve food and we all deserve to have enough food and healthy food. And if you do that, like, we would not debate whether you should be allowed to get food stamps if your parents don't work or you have a felony. Like, we would never say if your parent that a kid shouldn't go to school if their parent has been convicted of a felony. But we do say that with food stamps. And so we would focus on, you know, expanding the right and starting from that point. So that would be food stamps, universal lunch, like that everyone could get regardless of income, because there's been a lot in the news about like kind of the stigma of free lunch and what happens if kids can't pay. And so that's another kind of set of solutions.
Really great. Thank you.
Yeah, I will just add, in addition to, so in the book we sort of break it down. I mean, I, you know, and you're probably thinking, okay, but yeah, what can I really do in my individual home though, right? Because the policy change takes a long time, and as sociologists, that is the sort of thing that we're going to be looking at. But we also say, you know, we're thinking that there's things we can do at the community level and maybe some things we can do at the individual level. And so at the community level, we're saying, how can we get more creative? How can communities be more supportive of families, right? So, yes, I mean, in our communities, we'd like to see better school lunches, right, for our children, and this has been talked about for a long time now. We are not the first to, you know, suggest that. But also, like, how can we make use of sort of the resources that we already have in communities, like industrial kitchens? I remember that when I was a graduate student at NC State, I had both of my children while I was in graduate school, and so I was the daycare that I brought my son to, they started a program. They had a big industrial kitchen. It was a pretty good size daycare, family run though, local, so it was this really great place. And they said, we see that families are picking their kids up at 5:30, 6 o'clock at night, and then they're screaming out of here. So they decided to make to-go meals for families during the day. It was fantastic. And they were actually pretty affordable. I think they were like $12 for a family of four, which is way cheaper than even picking up something prepackaged at the grocery store for a family of four. So we were doing things like that, and it was such a big help. And, you know, so that's not going to solve our problems, or these big, big problems like obesity or, you know, problems with the, you know, questions we have about sustainability of the food system, and to the extent that there really are things going wrong with families or our moral fabric is coming unraveled, you know, I mean, you know, to-go meals isn't going to solve everything, right? But I think we can be working at different levels. And one thing, too, that I think we can do at the individual level is just take it down a notch. And that women have been encouraged, especially middle-class women, but women in general have been encouraged to ramp up their standards. So it's, like, not good enough to put a meal on the table. It has to be from scratch, and it has to be local, and it has to be organically sourced, right? And these are a lot of pressures. So now people are on Pinterest, and they're trying to make Pinterest-worthy meals, and they're trading recipes with friends, and they're reading the research. I mean, I interviewed a lot of these middle-class mothers, and they are really amped up. The anxiety's high. So, you know, what would sort of a form of resistance look like if we just said, okay, look, my whole self-worth does not have to be tied to this meal I put on the table. Yes, my family needs to eat. Yes, I care about their health, right? But there's probably a variety of different kinds of meals we can put on the table. And we say, look, if you need to throw a frozen pizza in the oven on a Wednesday night, throw a frozen pizza in the oven. Like, it's probably going to be okay, right? So
I want to talk more about that, but I want to I'm going to come back to that because that's a really good question about like the intensification of parenting and what are we talking about here? Because of course that's completely relevant in our recent news with regard to Operation Varsity Blues. But I want to actually, I'm just going to throw out this, is it a challenge? I'm not sure. But I'm hoping to get you to articulate against this argument. So we'll see. I'm saying that you reserve a lot of anger for the foodie call for the home-cooked meal. And you're, again, the subtitle, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems. But at the same time, many, if not all, of the people in your that you describe and that in your research have fond memories of their own families getting together for meals regularly and sharing home cooking. And that's sounds like it's across race and class. And they remember like, oh, remember when grandma got us all together? And oh, I remember sitting around, that was all of us getting together at her house and having chicken wings or whatever. Or they remember the nightly meal with so-and-so, so they miss it, even though they're not doing it. So my question is, why take aim at that vision? Why not instead take aim at the impediments to it? Or, to put this another way, is there any way that we can put a value on the home-cooked meal without setting an unattainable standard that then becomes just another way to tell low-income people that they're not measuring up? Assuming and that's a very credible point in this book, that making the home-cooked meal kind of a standard of basic parenting just is a way of kind of making low-income people or more disadvantaged populations feel bad. So if you take that as a given, is there a way to still value the home-cooked meal without doing that kind of culturally at them?
That's such a great question, and it's not an easy one to answer. I will say, we don't feel angry with the foodies. This is not a diatribe against a foodies, and I think that we share many things in common with the foodies. I mean, we care about the health of the planet, we care about people's health, we care about families and families carving out time to be families, and so we have a lot in common with the foodies. But the big difference, and I think that it's exciting for us to get to be in conversation, because as sociologists, we have a training that says, wait a minute, if we just look at the individuals, we're missing the sort of bigger societal problems that are shaping individuals' lives, and even the things they say they value, right? I know that you're a sociologist of culture, so you know that the things that are in the culture that are said to be important are also things then that we talk about as, yes, my family used to do this, what's I now idealized as this big Sunday dinner, and it was a very special moment. So I think that we are aware that when these discourses are circulating, that people can often see those as things to aspire to, things to remember fondly, things that they may feel some pressure bearing down on them around. But there's also a lot of research that shows us that if we focus on individuals as having the solutions, then we tend to blame individuals if they're not able to solve those problems at their individual level. So it makes it really easy for us to continue to say that the problems are that people just aren't trying hard enough, that people just don't care enough, that people just don't have the skills, and just with a little know-how and a little bit of elbow grease, we can solve this problem. And so the research shows us that when we think that individual solutions are going to make the difference, then we tend to focus very intently on what individuals are doing. And what we find in the book and what we find in some of the scholarly literature is that creates an arena of stigma. Right, people are feeling judged, feeling stigmatized, and Jocelyn can speak a little bit more to this since she studies the sociology of health, but there's a lot of research that shows that stigma is bad for our health, above and beyond. So if we just think that people are unhealthy because of the dietary practices they're making, we're kind of missing this larger component of how discrimination, how a sense of stigma or shame also shape our health and our well-being.
Yeah. I do want to add to that, too, that, you know, there were some mothers in the book who had, you know, I'm thinking of Ray Donahue, right? And she had, her family had put on these classic Southern family dinners on Sundays, and she missed that, and they weren't doing that with her son now. But there were also mothers in the book who actually had very fraught childhoods in terms of food. So Tara Foley was a one of the mothers that we share her story, and she grew up hungry. I mean, she just had a lot of food insecurity. Melanie Richards grew up in an Italian family, so at the same time that she had these love for Italian dishes, she also grew up with her family making fun of her weight, and food, she said, in her family was a source of comfort. So it was like a real double-edged sword for her. These weren't a whole lot of lovely memories all the time. Ashley Taylor's mother worked a lot while she was growing up, and she had to step in and do the cooking for her siblings. So, but now here she is as an young adult, and she's got her own two kids, and she's working a lot, and she doesn't really love cooking. And so I think one of the things that we want to challenge is this idea that cooking is just a natural extension of womanhood and mothering, that mothers were just made to do this. I mean, I think anecdotally about my own mother who loves to cook, but my stepmother who hates to cook, and it's such drudgery for her. And it's really, I've seen over the years, for the past 20 years, how she just forces herself to get in the kitchen, but this is not an art of love for her, right? While my dad, conveniently, does not do any of the cooking. And so, I mean, families do need to eat, and we are not saying let's do away with the family meal. Families do need to eat, but we're just asking questions like, how can we share this labor better? How can we make sure that they're actually supported to do this work? It's just, I think we're at the time where it's not enough to say, hey, you need to get in the kitchen and try harder. We need some resources, and we need some help doing that. And what happens if nobody ever loved cooking? What do we do then? And what happens to those mothers, you know? A lot of them talked about a lot of the shame and guilt that sort of came with not really loving to cook. And all of that said, I think to your question, that people do find lots of joy in the kitchen. They really, really do. But we want to solve some of these bigger pressing social problems we have, and we just don't think that's necessarily going to happen in the kitchen, so.
That's great, thank you. Two more questions I think we have time for maybe, and I'm trying to decide whether to go historical or go intensive parenting, which is very now. I suspect that there might be a question about intensive parenting, so I'm gonna go with historical. So just to reiterate this point that was made about how women used to do the midday meal, it's one of the really interesting kind of lessons that I gleaned from this book was the symbolic character of what we're talking about. And in my family sociology class, I do actually teach that in the 19th century, when work left the home, when work used to be everyone's working and everyone's at home, mothers are working, children are working, you know, because they're collecting the eggs or whatever, you know, like it's a family farm situation for a majority of households, and work is not different from home. So things like work-family conflict does not exist, because that was nonsensical at the time. Then work leaves the home. People leave the home to get paid, and all sorts of anxieties about what counts as family start to come about. And so this is actually the invention of a lot of cultural symbols, rituals that we do today to tell each other that we are related, that we are family. So that this is the moment at which the birthday party is invented. This is the moment at which family dinners are invented. People, like there's a lot of kind of cultural invention that happens right there because of people's anxiety about like, okay, if we're not all together all day, what are we and what counts as family? So given that subtext or that background, if we lose the family dinner due to a lot of things, among them the colonization of the 24-hour clock by work, what symbolic event around food will take its place? You know, we saw a move from the midday meal to whatever work will let us do, which at the time in the 19th century was the late night meal when they came home. If that's not possible, what will we lose food as a place at which we say to each other we are family, or what will return? That's a very hard question, but I want you to try it.
Okay. So, yeah, it is a great question. And I have always studied food even before this project, so I think I see food, like I always see food. I always think about food all
great.
The time.
You're the right person to ask.
But, so, yeah, that's a really hard question. I mean, one thing, my first reaction is that I don't think we're very close to that because that we have a lot of anxiety around dinner, but in half of U.S. families, people are cooking basically every single night. And that's not just eating together, but cooking dinner at home. And then in another, it's about 40%, 30%. It's more than half that are cooking almost every night, and then another 40% that are cooking like many nights per week, but you know they're eating out a few times. It's a small, small sliver that's really not eating, and I think it's a lot of younger people. It's more men. So in a lot of families, and in almost all of the families, especially the poor and working class families, which is something that I don't hear about in the news, but poor and working class families actually cook more together, not less. Huh. Like you kind of hear the
more than
middle class
families,
yeah,
because they're running off to soccer or whatever.
I think it's that, and then it's expensive. Like people told us, like no, we don't go to McDonald's. Even the dollar menu is definitely more expensive than like, you know, cooking spaghetti at home. Mm-hmm. So that's my first question. Like, my first thing is, I don't think that's happening.
We're not there yet.
But it is true. Like, it's hard for me to think of food not being a center point for people. And so it is true, as we push back against, like, does dinner need to be everything? Like, I think at holidays, in times of crisis, I was thinking about this because I had a friend who, someone in their family died. There's nothing you can do. So I don't really cook at all, but I did cook for this. And it's really because it's like the only way you have to show your care. Mm-hmm. And so I don't see it going away totally.
Yeah.
I think it means something to families and it means something to the people in our study. And I think there are other ways that families bond, like they bond, some people go camping together, some people, you know, play sports together or eat breakfast together. So I think there are other like family kind of touch points and that those, it may ebb and flow that those become more important, but I don't see the food going away. But it's a like fascinating question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm gonna ask one more and then we'll open it up to you guys to start thinking about what you wanna hear about. Let's see, I think I'm not gonna ask any of those how-to questions because those are all from sociology. About kids, maybe. I really appreciated the active role that kids play in the book. We see them negotiate for what they want, you know, goldfish, candy, etc. And in a few cases, actively defying caregivers who are trying to impose healthier diets. Like there was one case where I was like, oh my God, where she's like,
Rosario's daughter?
Yes!
Yes, Gabby.
Where she was like, here's some cookies. Cookies! But we also see them absorbing lessons about trying to save money and like, are grapes good for you, mommy? And you know, like kind of trying to participate in this larger question. And so I wanna know kind of how did you approach children in this project and did that change over the course of the study?
Yes, so children they're just wonderful to spend time with. Anybody who spent time with kids, right? Especially when they're not yours. I know. I have two children. So we started, we chose families who had children between the ages of 2 and 8. This is at least one child between that age range. And so many of the families have more than one child, but there was typically a child in that younger age range. And we chose that child as what we called our focal child. So that was the child that we collected a little bit more information about and followed or tracked over those 5 years. And we really got to watch, and as they grew and as they started to make some of these links between is this healthy? How do we eat this? Is this wrong? You know, I'm gaining weight. How do I handle it? I've been teased at school. And then sort of watching how parents are trying to navigate this terrain of, I want my kids to have this good self-esteem, but I'm also worried about them being teased or not, you know, being fit. So how do I maybe talk about their diet or get them a little bit more active without making them feel self-conscious? But we also just thought kids are such active, you know, making sense of the world. And so we hadn't intended to, but in the last year of the study, we interviewed the children themselves, which was really challenging and interesting in its own right, because interviewing children, they were from the ages of 7 to 14, presents a whole bunch of different challenges. So we came up with different things that would perhaps help different ages, and they didn't work for all children, but you know, this was just invaluable, because it's also to think about, parents don't always have complete control, right? Kids are actively negotiating and trying to figure out how far they can push their parents on this and that, and also just making sense of, you know, where they fit in this larger scheme of things. And so the interviews were really, a beautiful window into the meaning-making that children were doing around food and family and health. I'll let Sarah and Jocelyn talk a little bit more.
Well, I mean, if you're not inspired, we should go to questions. Yeah, 10 minutes late. Sorry. Oh, good. So let's see. Let's have one and then two. Yeah, go ahead.
So do you have any comments about how low-income families handle food allergies, or is that a middle-class, upper-class concern, obsession, privilege?
Well, yeah, no. I think some of the families in the low-income study that we followed did have children who had intolerances or allergies and were struggling with some of the same issues. I think we see predominantly, I think, or think of potentially as a more middle class issue, but didn't always have the resources to, buffer their children from these. So I'm thinking of one mother, for example, whose daughter had a host of health conditions that the mother had eventually established were food related, and she had figured out certain things that if she didn't feed her daughter those foods, her health was better. But this was things like if she fed her organic meat rather than conventionally grown, she saw a difference in her daughter. So what she had figured out was ways to barter with people in her community, and so I should say that one of our communities was rural, one was semi-rural, and one was urban. So we were trying to also think about food access, food security in these different areas. And so this worked for this family in particular, because they were in a rural area, and they were able, I believe, did Robin also have chickens? Or was mm-hmm. that? Yes, and mm-hmm. also had chickens. And on a very shoestring budget, was trying to figure out how to navigate these health issues of her daughter's. I think it was rashes that her daughter would get if she was exposed to certain foods that were maybe processed or conventionally grown.
So interesting.
Yes, but I think she also said, you know, her daughter just had a limited diet, right? So that was one way that she handled it, was just, you know, there were these few things that she knew weren't going to engender that reaction, and so she kind of stuck to those. And this is something that we also knew from the lower-income families in general, that food waste is a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And so you don't buy something if you think that nobody's going to eat it. It's not going to be eaten. So you don't waste food.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I wondered if you ladies encountered this. When I was in graduate school in London in the early 2000s, and that's when you really had this movement of access to food, wanting people that they noticed that people were changing their eating habits so much. And
any feminist with a like tutu yearning daughter, you know, that's the same humility. So. You just gotta go, okay, there you go. Oh well.
Yes, yeah, yes. We so the first question about, I think what you're talking about is sort of food deserts, which have gotten a lot of attention in the last 10 years in Europe and here. I think partly it's because it's a concept that's easy for people to understand, like, and it's easy to see. Like, you can definitely see it in Raleigh, where I live and where we did the study, that there are more grocery stores in the richer neighborhoods. And then in the one neighborhood, they lost their only grocery store during our study, so then they became an official food desert. And I think that matters because it makes it harder for people, especially people who don't have cars, which was a lot of people in our study. But it is true that like the best research has shown that it probably doesn't make that big of a difference. And we found that in our study. And I think the reason, which is so obvious, but it took the academics a while to figure this out, is that people don't necessarily shop at their closest store. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a lot of money, that's even more true. Like, a lot of the, so one of our graduate students for the project, she specifically like kind of mapped out where people shopped, and she found that Walmart was not the closest store for any of the moms in this one neighborhood, but like half of them still, that was their main store because it was cheaper, or they perceived it. So I think I think getting stores into neighborhoods is important, but it kind of like, it was kind of a craze for a while, and it's really not the most important thing because prices are more important to people than having enough money. In terms of cultivating children's palates, I know that Jocelyn has written a lot about this, so I'll let you
So
that.
What you're saying about sort of these humbling moments as parents, and I have had plenty of those humbling moments myself, but yeah, when I'm thinking of one of the middle-class mothers in the book, her name is Marta, and she's a health person. This is what her degree is in. She lives this, she breathes this, and she really wants her kids to be healthy, and she is just constantly doing battle with her older son, who will eat like three foods. And he's also always kind of been like a skinny kid, and so she was kind of worried about that, but the pediatrician reassured her, no, he's going to be fine, but just try to get his like a variety of foods into him. And her whole thing was like, she's feeding for the future. She's like, whatever I give him now, basically, in her mind, it was like she felt like this is the kind of eater he's going to be when he's 20. And so she was trying to cultivate all of those good habits now, and this kid was resisting her like every minute of the day, and it was so exasperating. And so she started resorting to all these things that even her own training had told her that you're not supposed to do. She told me in the interview that she set a timer at dinner. And she would set the timer and she'd say to her son, okay, you have to eat as much as you can, like until this timer goes off. And then she told me in the next breath, she's like, actually, that was so ridiculous. It just made dinner so uptight and right, but this is what it has come to. This is how intensely mothers feel that so much is on the line with this bite of asparagus, that if I can't get him to eat this, well, that's it. He's gonna turn into an obese adult who does nothing but eat McDonald's, right? I mean, there seemed to be in a lot of ways this direct correlation in their heads. So the question that we could ask is, are these just neurotic mothers? And the answer is no. They are getting these messages from so many different places, right? From TV and from commercials and from magazines and the things they're reading online. And they're being told, your baby is the most precious thing you have, right? Set them up for success. And they have more resources than the poor mothers did, so they felt like they should be able to do this. But then like so many things were throwing a wrench into their plans, including kids who were like, I just want to eat the chicken nuggets. Like that's.
So much to say that.
Yes.
I'm not going to. Yes.
That kind of segues into what I was going to ask. I have a 5-year-old and constantly battling over sugar intake.
Yeah.
But also, I feel like that's a big craze right now, too. So I'm not sure how much of that is my own kind of need and want for her or societal, you know, pressure. And I'm kind of confused by that. Listening to you all talk about asparagus, I feel like I'm doing the same thing with sugar.
Yeah.
And she's doing well with the vegetables.
Ah, thank you. Finally, the question. Okay, so I'm going to piggyback onto that, which is to talk about the intensification of parenting. And let's just call it mothering for 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many determinants to it, but I'm just going to throw one out there for you all, which is thinking about, you could call it hubris maybe, the idea that parents have that much impact on their children. mean, there's a lot of work suggesting now that greater rising insecurity and rising inequality raises the stakes of parenting, and that's one of the reasons why we have the intensification of parenting now, because, like, the stakes are high, and, you know, they might be deep, you know, the chasm is wide between us. But I'm going to throw out another one, which is, in the United States, we don't really, is it the overemphasis on psychology? I'm not sure, but we don't have a notion of the active child, really. We do not have a sense that children make a difference. Children are things that you do things to, not really that participate or that do things also.
They're projects that you cultivate.
They're projects that you cultivate, exactly. And that actually contrasts with England and the UK and, I mean, and the Nordic countries in particular, which have a very strong tradition of looking at children as active agents. Their children vote, their children are on city councils, they have, like, you know, a lot of different, they have child autonomy in ways that we do not. And I wonder whether our intensification of parenting is in part relying on this kind of, I would say, cultural hubris around, like, that parents can control things like their children, that parents actually make a difference. Yeah. I mean, I feel like parents can ruin children, but I'm not sure parents can make children better than they were going to be. So, I don't know. That's my own philosophy. Sorry. Forget the sugar question. Let's just talk about intensification of mothering while you're in there.
So, I've been thinking about this a lot because I spent last year in Sweden. And they do definitely have a certain type of intensification of parenting. It is parenting, and, like, Swedish dads take a lot of the parental leave, and they actually basically have to, so they're more involved in parenting, so I think that makes a difference. It's not as intense, and I think I have been thinking about it mostly in terms of the risk, because, in Sweden, a lot of the benefits are not tied to your job. Like, you have healthcare, and you have retirement, and you have vacation, and parental leave, and none of that has to do with your job. So I think that the parents feel less frantic about, like, I think American parents about food, like Jocelyn was saying, but about everything, feel like everything rests on what will my child be doing at age 25, and when your kid is 5, you have no idea. And so that really ramps up the pressure. But you're totally right. It took us a long time to, like, really grasp, just, like, experientially, like, the kind of Swedish children have rights. Like, they are their own person with rights. So they have prohibited spanking. They were, like, the first country to prohibit spanking. And it's basically because if a child has essentially equal rights to an adult, like, of course you can't spank them, because it's not the parents. Like, in the U.S., I feel like parents have so many. Our conception is, like, that parents have the right to raise their kids exactly the way they want. And that is tied to and that goes with the lack of, like, social supports, because we kind of, that's the other thing that I think makes it hard. Even if the government suddenly came and was like, we will offer preschool for all children, like, we have such an individualized conception of how we want to be able to raise our children our way that it would be. It would be very hard, I think.
The frontier is here in every home.
Yeah.
Okay, but you have to address the sugar lady because
we just talked about sugar recently.
Do you have a sugar answer?
I don't, except that I feel what you're feeling. You know. And,
yeah.
Sympathy. That's what you're getting.
I do think it's hard, right? And I think that, you know, that yes, we know that kids like sugar. They like the taste of it. They like salt. They like the taste of it. And there's a lot to go around. And I do think that, you know, there are studies that say, oh, sugar's bad or salt's bad. And so, yeah, to want to restrict or to reduce the sugar intake, it seems like in this cultural context, sure, you might feel some anxiety about it. But I just feel sympathy because, I don't know. I had kids who would eat about 3 things growing up, and now they're adults, and they eat everything.
Same.
You too. And so I do think, yes, I appreciate Allison's point of how much control do we have as parents. But I also appreciate the point of that this sense of control that we have is one of the things we have in the U.S., right? This is our domain, and this is our job. And so I don't think there are any easy answers. But maybe we could chat afterwards.
But maybe that's helpful. I don't know if that's helpful, but as someone who's a parent of 20-ish year olds, you know, they eat broadly and widely across and many things that I, you know, mm-hmm. they eat, they have a normal adult diet of great variety and health. And when they were little, they ate only white foods or beige foods that didn't touch and just a sparkle and, you know, like that kind of thing. So.
Chicken fingers and plain pasta.
Exactly.
I think whatever.
No,
no, yes.
Yeah. I think whenever I start to worry about, like, am I being a good enough parent, and my kid's going to be okay, I always just go back to, like, the 80s. And that was my childhood. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, everything's going to be fine. Because in the 80s, I ate a ton of sugar. I watched a ton of TV. My mom never breastfed me. Look at me. I'm doing great. I mean, I sort of sometimes, like, I use that as my anchor point to remember or just keep myself. Right, exactly, exactly. Like, I just try to give myself a reference point to keep myself in check or keep myself in perspective and go, okay. It's probably going to be okay. And there's definitely things my parents did, and I do not want to do those things, and I don't want to repeat those things. I'm sure we all have that. But I don't know. I feel like it was a free-for-all in the 80s. But like
it's Stranger Things.
Yeah, right? But we kind of made it through okay. And there were some long-lasting repercussions of maybe some of those ways of eating and some of those policies in the 80s. But, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Other questions? We should probably conclude in about 2 minutes. So, yeah.
Yeah, so that's still ongoing, so I don't have any answers, but the puzzle that I was trying to look at is that in this project, and in the book we talk about immigrant families and some of the challenges they face, and specifically how the nutritionists know that often immigrants have healthier diets than their native-born counterparts when they arrive, and then over time, and especially across generations, their diets get less healthy. So the kind of idea in the nutrition literature, it's always, like, I always have this image of, like, people are just, like, they're magnetized to McDonald's and soda and things like that. But in
the
U.S.
But what is it in Sweden, I wonder?
Yeah, so, and we, but so based on our research, though, we hypothesized and saw that it's linked to specific things about living in the U.S., like the school lunches, which are, at least where we live, it's a lot of chicken nuggets and pizza. And then the kids like that. And WIC, which we mentioned, like WIC, you have to buy certain foods, and they're American kind of foods.
Cereal, yeah.
Right, lots of cereal and peanut butter. And the weird thing about Sweden is that, so Sweden is much better with their policies to integrate immigrants. They have a lot more support, not surprisingly, but the same kind of thing is happening. But they've solved a lot of the poverty problems. So I don't have the answer yet. But
by
that's
the same thing you mean.
The immigrants' diets basically start out better and get worse and worse.
Oh.
And I think it's not because of poverty. In Sweden, part of it, I think, is that it takes immigrants a long time to get integrated into the system, like to become employed. So, like, once you're in the system in Sweden, and if you're in, it's good. Your kids have, like, free daycare and got all the stuff, but like if you're out of the system, like you're really out, and so that's like kind of a high barrier to entry. But Sweden and the Scandinavian countries, like they are really trying to grapple with immigration. They are not nearly as homogenous as their kind of as stereotypes of them as like these kind of blonde populations suggest, and they have not figured out like the best way to do it, and so that does matter, since we kind of are uphold, like, some of our conclusions are basically, like, let's implement these plans. There are a lot like Sweden and these other countries, but they have some big problems to solve, too.
And on that note,
sorry.
Please let's give them a round of applause. Very nice to see you. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, Allison.